You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
In a small corner of the most populous country in Africa, billions of dollars of crude oil flow under the feet of a desperate people. Immense wealth and abject poverty stand in stark contrast. The environment is decimated. The issues are complex and the answers elusive. The award-winning documentary film, Sweet Crude, tells the story of Nigeria's Niger Delta and is being featured at the World Community Film Festival this weekend at Langara College. Sandy Siafi is director of Sweet Crude, and she joins me by phone this morning to talk about the making of her film. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning.
What does Sweet Crude mean?
Sweet crude is actually a term for oil that doesn't have much sulfur in it. So one of the ironies in the Niger Delta is that the oil from that area happens to be very, quote-unquote, clean by oil company standards, and it requires very little processing. So it's extra valuable. But, of course, the irony is that for the people who live there, the environment has been completely devastated. So I just appreciated the oxymoron of it, which is why I titled the film Sweet Crude.
What effect has oil drilling had on the people who live in the Niger Delta?
Well, oil was first really discovered in the area in the late 1950s, so it's just about a 50-year period exactly. And in those 50 years, the life expectancy, for example, has gone from the late 60s, people would typically live into their late 60s, and now life expectancy in the oil-producing communities is 40. That's just one of the many, unfortunately, many difficult statistics, because it's hard to really move people with statistics. But visually, for us on the crew, on the film crew, as soon as we got there, we would see these very unusual-looking, ominous gray clouds that were, we found out later, filled with acid rain. And acid rain is a consequence of the ubiquitous gas flaring. There's gas flaring all over the Delta. In fact, the largest amount of gas flaring left on the planet is done in two places, Russia and Nigeria. And in fact, it's so substantial that you can see it from outer space photography. You see this little band in the center of Africa of yellow light, and that's the gas flaring. And that's just one of the environmental issues. The other mangroves that are gone from the dredging and the mixing of sweet and salt water, the poisonous fish from the oil spills. I mean, we could spend the entire time talking about the environment.
And do the local people share in any of the wealth that's generated from the extraction of that resource?
Almost none of them do. There are a few people who have managed to sort of get their hand in the pie, but the average person, a woman and her family living in a Delta village, is in fact one of the poorest people in all of Africa. The poverty level in the oil-producing communities of the Niger Delta is as low as it gets in Africa. And that, you know, there are many, many reasons that this has happened, but one of the reasons that's important to note is that the British left their colonial rule in Nigeria at exactly the same moment that the corporations established theirs. So the colonial template was simply replaced with a corporate template. So the ways that the dictators were playing ethnic groups against each other was, unfortunately, a convenient tactic that was continued under the rule of oil.
Now, Sani, I understand that you originally went to Nigeria to film the opening of a library, but ended up making this documentary about the resource war in the Niger Delta. What changed that? What was the turning point for you?
Well, I was hired by an American nonprofit organization to film this group of Americans going to help out. And it all seemed perfectly fine. I mean, I wasn't completely naive. I had done some research, and I knew who Ken Saro-Wiwa was. But it seemed like the communities of the Delta were on the better end of the oil relative to the media I was reading in 2005, that things had gotten better. Not only is that not true, but things have gotten so much worse, and the people have been organizing and, I mean, doing everything you can imagine to ask the world community to pay attention to their plight as the world community is consuming their resources. And so as soon as I arrived in the village of Oporosa and saw that what was happening there bore no resemblance to the story I was hearing in American, certainly American media, I knew that I had to go back, and it wasn't really right for me to simply make this piece about a group of people in almost a benevolent patriarchy kind of way, even though that's not what they intended. But why would people in the Niger Delta need a library when they are producing millions and millions of dollars of oil revenue? Obviously, something's gone wrong. So the real turning point for me was one woman, a mother in a community called Jones Creek. We had been told by Chevron, and early on Chevron gave us interviews when we were just working on the library. We were seen as, you know, the good guys who were just going to help out the poor people of the Delta. And Chevron told me that they no longer flared on the ground because that was one of the more egregious crimes in the world community. And, in fact, the International Monetary Fund had come down hard on Chevron. I mean, as hard as they come down, which, you know, is a light smack. And Chevron swore that they no longer flared on the ground. And this mother in Jones Creek, as soon as she saw me with my camera, physically grabbed me and pulled me a mile in off the waterway and showed me where the gas flaring was occurring, literally right off the ground. Gas flaring that has caused third-degree burns for many children. I mean, I could tell you the number of young people I saw with third-degree burns was shocking. And as soon as I saw that and filmed it and this mother was begging me to come back with the camera, I knew that I would do a feature-length documentary.
That's an amazing story. She must have been a courageous woman.
Yes, very.
In your film, you show that the people of the Delta were well organized and empowered to peacefully negotiate resource control and self-determination for many years, but eventually a movement developed out of desperation, which uses arms and kidnapping as a means to get attention for their cause. What perspective do you take on this change in tactics?
Well, you know, I tried very hard to be careful to neither judge it nor promote it, because it's certainly the case that it's easy for me, a white woman living in Northern America, to say that I'm for nonviolence. I mean, what does that mean when the stakes of my everyday life are not the stakes of their life? And I've come to understand when I'm in places like the Niger Delta or Northern Ireland or Nicaragua that if I watched my grandmother, and this is literally the life experience of many of these young men, if I watched my grandmother go out in a canoe to get her daily food and be raped by Nigerian military officers because she's in an oil-producing community and they want to continue to dehumanize the people there, I don't know what I would do if I were organizing, marching, going to international conferences, calling on the UN. And if I did that for a decade with no response from American media, but the moment I pick up a gun, put on a mask, and stand in front of a camera, bam, CNN is there, Reuters is there, BBC, ABC News. They all want to tell the story of the Niger Delta all of a sudden. Of course, they don't want to tell the whole story of the Niger Delta. You know, that backfires because all they want to do is say, terrorist, terrorist. So that has its own dangers. But I tried very hard to say the reality that I saw on the ground are people who used a larger strategy of nonviolence for a long time. And within that nonviolent strategy, all kinds of tactics, including the attempt to get international media attention. But it was unsuccessful, and the international media attention came when they picked up guns. So I'm just asking the audience to take that in and ask ourselves what our responsibility is to even leave a window open for political solutions in places where the stakes are that high. Don't we, after all, bear responsibility for whether or not that can be resolved nonviolently?
Sandy, during the making of the film, I understand that ABC News wanted to run a story on the situation and asked you to use your contacts to set up an interview with one of the local leaders. What was the outcome of that interview?
Yes, that's correct. It was for ABC News Nightline and World News Now, and it's a reporter named Brian Ross, and his producers had me sort of playing the role of fixer, and I thought that was terrific because I thought they were going to do the deeper story. What happened is that within 48 hours of our leaving, they canceled because a reporter named Sebastian Junger, who writes for Vanity Fair, had actually just been in the Delta for a couple of days. And because ABC has a corporate relationship with Condé Nast, the footage that Sebastian brought back was footage that ABC was sort of bound to run. So I went ahead and filmed an interview. I filmed the Nigerian side of the interview. Brian Ross filmed the telephone side in New York. And I brought the footage on my way back into the United States to New York. And I, again, was hopeful that somehow the footage of a young man unmasked saying, I am a militant in the Niger Delta, but this is why I've picked up guns. This is what we're asking for in the world community. Not only did Brian Ross not run any of that footage, he instead went with a story that used the word terror, terrorist, or terrorism 43 times and called MEND the new African terror threat. So it was really pretty devastating all around, and a very, unfortunately, a typical example of what passes for journalism in the current in electronic media environment in the U.S.
Now, I understand it was extremely dangerous for you to make this film. You were arrested. You were harshly interrogated for a week in Nigeria. You were at risk of being sold to criminals, and you were working with highly sensitive contact information. Why did you take these risks to make this film?
Well, I think that for as much as all of that can, you know, perhaps suggest that I or my crew are brave and, you know, we deserve to be lauded, what we went through is literally infinitesimal compared to the conditions of life of those people and people, frankly, all over the world on the other end of resource control issues. I mean, this is the most, from my point of view, there is no more compelling question of whether or not we can live in a world with any sort of human rights standards when the alchemy of guns and oil are what they are. So I didn't so much sit with a calculator, you know, and say, am I willing to risk all those things to tell this story? But I do know that, in general, my commitment to independent documentary is that it's, of course, the most voiceless people who are continue to be trampled around the world, and those are the places where the cameras don't go. There really aren't any news agencies who go there for more than 48 hours dropped in a helicopter, and they stay safe. And if you're going to tell the story of people for whom the stakes are that high, the stakes have to be that high for you, too. If you wear, you know, the bulletproof vest and the guest pass, you're not really going to tell their story. So it's not at all that I mean to purport that I have any sort of, you know, false modesty. It's that I really felt, even when I was in prison, that what I was experiencing was next to nothing. Nigerian journalists are beaten up daily if they tell any real stories. So I was unfortunately in a long line of thousands of people who have to risk that if those stories will ever be told.
What's the current situation in the Niger Delta?
It's actually newly urgent. The president, Yara Dwa, has been quite ill, and his vice president is from the Niger Delta, which was unprecedented and considered a little bit of a sliver of hope. But Yara Dwa, it would appear, is not really running the government, and the military officers surrounding him are not allowing the vice president to take power. So there is, in fact, Secretary of State of the United States Hillary Clinton yesterday made a statement about the urgency of allowing the Constitution to prevail, which is not to say that the U.S. position on Nigeria is always terrific, but it shows you that it's internationally significant enough and urgent enough that even she spoke up yesterday. So there's concern that if the military officers truly do not allow, his name is Goodluck Jonathan, to take power, that there could well be a full-on civil war. And very unfortunately, because most of the world does not know what goes on in Nigeria, they will just be told that it is an extreme Muslim-Christian question, which on the one hand is a part of the story, but they will not be told the role that oil is playing, which is the major player on the stage of this terrible tragedy. So the militancy, which is called MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, just this morning officially sent out to all of their press contacts an email saying that they've called off their ceasefire. So it is a very, the situation is at a critical tipping point, and our paying any attention to it, I believe, could have something to do with which way it tips.
Well, what can people do if they want to try to influence the situation?
If you go to sweetcrudemovie.com, there's a page called Politics and Action, and if you go there and sign up, we will send you action alerts when you can send petitions, emails, letters, and there have actually been several times that we've managed to move U.S. senators with emails from people all over the world to make statements and do quick intervention. And some of it's been urgent moments where there was an actual call for a ceasefire, things like that. So because the situation is moving under our feet, the action steps are not concrete. We just, you know, we move with it. So if you sign up, we'll definitely alert you to action you can take along the way.
Well, it's been fantastic talking to you this morning, Sandy, and I hope people go out to see the screening of your film tomorrow.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Sandy Siofi about her award-winning documentary, Sweet Crude. Sweet Crude is playing tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. as part of the World Community Film Festival taking place at Langara this weekend. And if you want more information about tickets or a complete schedule of films, you can visit codev.org/filmfest. As Sandy mentioned, if you want to give an active response on the situation in the Niger Delta, you can go to their website at sweetcrudemovie.com and look for activist actions there.